Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming. I know it was probably very difficult given the number of people I saw yesterday in the city center. So this presentation is not a full training about radar, but a presentation that focuses on the different contacts you can enter into the program and what they are used for. Next slide, please. So this is the main screen of radar, where you have to type your login and password. If for any reason you don't have the password, you can use the link to recover it. And if for some reasons you are not successful, then you can send an email to radaradmin@icon.org in order to get a new password.
Maybe we slow down a little bit. There's people still coming in.
Yeah.
I had trouble at the entrance. I forgot my thing in the hotel room. And I was about a second thinking of let's go in and try how hard these people are.
No audio.
But actually, I think they were no match for me, but I don't want to show audio. Sorry.
So I'm not the question?
Sure. Maybe you can switch off your microphone so everybody can hear your question.
Okay, I see that you log in with the IANA ID and password. Mm-hmm. If you don't have your password, it says you can use the forget password link, but that says use your email address. What email address is that? Is that not working?
Cut your microphone when
okay.
You finish, because then I... Okay. Once you are in the account, there is a user profile, which includes an email address, and this is the one the new temporary password is sent to if you use the link. Unfortunately, this profile is not linked to the registrar contact, so the registrars do not always think to update it even when they update their registrar's records, and that's the reason why they may think that the recovery tool doesn't work, but it actually does.
Yep. Next slide, please.
Sorry.
Once you are logged in, you arrived.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know we're late, but can I just have a look at the page before? I know I'm late, but you know.
It doesn't.
Sure,
we've
Christian.
Got plenty of time.
Sorry.
This is for your benefit, so don't.
No problem.
Okay, I at least want to see the login and we're off.
So for those remotely participating, Christian Müller asked me to see the first page again. Welcome.
Okay.
This is a screen where you arrive after logging in. The different contacts are displayed on your right in the right table. And if you click on any of these contacts, except for the primary contact, which I will explain later, you will be able to edit that contact. So this is the window that will appear if you click on the concerned contact. Then, yes?
Hi, James Bladel, GoDaddy. So, and I apologize if I'm getting out of sequence here, but the way you described it earlier was that this is not linked to the registrar data information that was submitted in the accreditation. Or this is now editing that information?
When the registrar gets the initial accreditation, I send to the applicant at that moment the radar contact form. Then when I receive the form, I fill in myself all the contact details, and the registrar will get the credentials to its radar account, via which he will be able to update all these contacts later, except the primary, which is a special case I will explain afterwards.
Just so you understand, James, all existing registrars were grandfathered. Their data was grandfathered into radar when we converted to radar some time ago. So, your data would have been there, populated from years ago, and then it gets updated as either you tell us or you change something. I'm not sure if that's what you were trying to get at.
Yes, it is, and thanks, Tim. And I appreciate that. However, we are continuously updating and managing our contact data as we update our contacts and teams. But I did have one question, and I don't know if it was covered in the first slide. I was not here late, so I'm maybe just missing the elephant in the room. But what is radar for? What does it stand for, and who uses it?
You forgot that. That's
an excellent question. Radar is the interface for the registrars, for the ICANN accredited registrars, to manage its contact information on one hand, to manage the information it makes publicly available, which includes the public contact, its URL, its logo description that you will see on icon.org/registrars and then the link list of accredited registrar, or on the website interdict.net and then the link registrar. And this is also the interface, and there is a point about it later. It's also the interface via which the registrar will be able to request to add the GTLD to its accreditation, which is very important with the forthcoming new GTLD program, because once any GTLD gets created, you as a registrar will be able to request to add it to your accreditation.
Can I jump in here and add a little bit too? Radar itself is an acronym that stands for Registrar Application and Data Access Resource. It was originally envisioned that it would be a combination of an online accreditation application process and the data tool. We ended up doing the data tool but not the online application process, at least in the first phase, because it gives us more people that get more benefit out of it, being able to manage their contacts this way. We felt that there had been too many data errors in the past in terms of registrars, changing their contacts or their billing address or whatever, and then we were manually entering that information, and then it would also go to our billing department and so forth. This way, the registrar is basically responsible for the accuracy of the data that gets put in there, and we feel that's a better approach, and it's not, it was designed to be somewhat like how a registrant controls their own registration information at your, company's websites. We wanted to have something that kind of put it back in the hands of the users.
So, an important feature, if you wish to change the data associated with more than one of your contacts, and you want to apply exactly the same contact information to more than one contact, you don't need to go and change it for all of them. For example, you want to change to put the same person with the same details for your abuse and billing contact. You will choose one of them. You will update the contact details, and then you will have different checkboxes below with the other possible contacts, and you will be able, by crossing the concerned one, to apply exactly the same change to that contact.
So in other words, you can change multiple contacts all at one time.
The exception is the primary contact. If you click in the right table we just saw before, on primary contact, this is what you will see. You cannot change the primary contact online because it's the contractual contact of your registrar with ICANN. Instead of that, there is a form which you can reach from that page, which looks like that. This is a form you have. You can fill in the form via your computer because it's an editable PDF, but you have to print out the form and to send it by fax or by post to ICANN.
Cool.
This form, as you can see... Oh, sorry.
So the question is that the primary contact is also the primary user of the radar system, but can there be multiple user accounts for a radar system associated with each registrar?
Yes, there can be multiple user account, and I will show you after how you can create other users and how they will be able to enter into the system.
But if they have the same IANA ID, so they have the
yes,
same
it
login.
Will be the same IANA ID, but of course they will receive another username which you will give them than just the IANA ID, which is the default username given at the beginning to the primary contact.
Okay, thank you.
And just as a security measure, changes that are made in radar, an email is generated to the primary contact when changes are made, so that if you grant access to different people, the primary contact will still know if things have been changed. So that was sort of our default security measure there to avoid any inappropriate changes.
Okay, so I don't know my password. I just try to get it. I got an email with a link. The link is asking me for my birth city. First, I cannot remember that I ever submitted my birth city to you guys, and subsequently, the input is rendered as invalid. So, what do I do now?
I think I know the reason, Christian, because if I remember well, when the account was created, you were not the primary contact. It was your colleague, Harry.
Yeah.
And
no.
And
he is Romanian, you know. If I know, I probably can't spell even the city.
And you subsequently asked us to update the primary contact to you
with
that form.
I remember.
But you didn't, or he didn't, update the user profile as I showed earlier in the left table. So if you go there, you will probably still see Harry's details, and he's probably the one who set up that question.
You know, I do have contact to Harry, and I could ask him if he wouldn't be in the hospital since a couple of months after having a stroke. But, you know, so I have probably no chance let him doing that. So I
in that case, I will send an email to the address that was listed, radaradmin@ican.org, or directly to me if you want. I will give you a new password, and once you have the password, you will be able to update the user data as well.
You could do that for him later today, right? You could do it for him today here.
Yes, I can do it here as well, indeed.
Go ahead. Once we are
in.
Okay.
Sure.
Thanks.
So the form also allows the registrar to update its URL, because the URL is in the same situation as the primary contact. It's a contractual information which is mentioned on page 21 of the RAA. So if you want to update it, you can't do it online. You have to use the form or send us an official letter if you prefer. So now I'm going to explain what the different contacts are used for, because there's of course a reason if we ask you to populate all this contact information. So we start with the primary contact. It's your contractual contact with ICANN, who receives notice under the RAA, and that contact is shared with the registries, the one of the GTLDs that are included in your accreditation, of course. There is an abuse contact, which is not used so far, but there are some discussions pending between ICANN and the registries, because they would like to get the specific contact for abuse. So we may use it in the future and also provide the related contact details to the registries. The billing contact, as its name says, this is where ICANN's invoices to the registrar are sent, which by itself justifies that you always have to keep it updated, because if not, you will not receive your invoice. Then you will not pay them and may get into trouble with David's department.
Steve, could you explain something? Maybe you could just repeat the question. Mm-hmm. You explained that...
If you can switch on your microphone.
I'm going to ask you to repeat the question.
Okay.
That if you put an email address, you won't automatically receive bills by email, will you?
No, the bills are not sent by email. They generally are sent by post or by courier. Komaki once told me that there was no feature in their software so far to have the bills sent by email. Complaint and data escrow contacts. They are not used so far. They were also created for possible future use. Then if we want to use them, they will already be there and will not require any development work from the responsible IT people at ICANN. Yes?
Now that you mentioned that they were for future use, but now that the data escrow program is up and running, why wouldn't we... ask registrars to provide an appropriate contact for that program?
Because when the registrar enters into the RDE agreement with ICANN and most of the time with Iron Mountain, the registrar has to determine a data escrow contact on that contract, and since it is a contract, we are in the same situation as with the primary. We cannot change it, and it's possible that we update radar in the future in a such way that the registrar will not have the possibility to update that contact itself, but will have to fill in a form, as it is the case for the primary contact. And yes?
So I work for an internet company, do lots of user interface design, we all work for technology companies. If a feature isn't actually there, isn't it just common sense just to sort of remove these contact details, just to strip it down? If we have lots of sort of details which serve no purpose, could we not just delete them from the interface?
I'm just going to answer you that the creation of radar has not been made without troubles. There have already been several updates since its initial creation, and it's never a simple thing. I don't know all details because I'm not the person doing that. It's actually one person specifically responsible for that. And given its situation, that it's also linked to other application used by the billing department. It's also linked to the Internic website. It already happened by updating some features in Radar that it could cause some unexpected problems.
It does seem like a very simple thing, though.
I think you make a good point. I think we'll take that back with us and see whether or not it makes sense just to disable some of the contact fields until we start using them.
Mm-hmm. If I didn't need to fill that in, then you know, probably.
Yeah.
I'm not great, that's the waste of my time, but you know, this kind of trouble, just gray them so that anybody who wants to fill them out for future use, I would probably do just in case.
It's
not a huge problem, but it's a symptom of the wider sort of state of affairs that you have a whole load of interfaces which don't really mean anything.
I get his point. On the other hand, you know, I'm certain that there are, if I judge, I can write. They are like the German Telekom, for example. So they have a group of 20 people discussing since about 3 years how this interface is going. Is that right? So no,
it's not 20; it's 2. But no, you're absolutely right.
Some of this was considered.
Both of you are right for different reasons.
Some of this was considered potential. You know. What would be helpful, you know, eventually, but, you know, you're right. Until we actually start using them, some of those things probably don't need to be. I mean, it would be nice for us to have the Radar contact here and be able to manage it, but because it's an actual contractual, you know, who's named in the contract, is the kind of thing that we don't want to make easily changeable unless you're going to change the contract. So that's an example where... It was a good idea, but it hasn't necessarily been enacted properly. So I think we'll take that under advisement and see whether there's a way to do that.
Maybe graying them out is some sort of a, you know, in-between thing, so that you can actually see that these are not important right now, but without changing everything and discussing for another 2 years.
Yeah, that's probably an option to have them disappear from the front end, even if we still see something in the back end. So, as for the complaints, you probably already received some complaints submitted via the form on internic.net. In that situation, the complaint is forwarded to the registrar's primary contact.
Yeah, cool.
Public contact, so as its name says, available to the public via these two links on respectively the Internic and the ICANN website. That's the list of all ICANN accredited registrars. And important thing, especially for registrars that have either the principal place of business in another country than its registration place, or that have different subsidiary, the country that you will populate as in the public contact information will be the country where you will be listed. If you check the link on internic.net, this is where it's particularly relevant. You will have the possibility to get the list sorted out by country of registrars, and it will take that country into account to sort out the concerned registrar. Transfer contact, used for transfer issues, and it is shared between all registrars. So this is the view that we showed before. In the left tables you have a link view all registrars, and this is where you will be able to reach the transfer contact details of all other registrars.
Is that mandatory? Mandatory that you have it, or yeah, if you don't fill it in, we will put the primary contact information in that field. But this is important because this is one of the key things that you know, the transfer policy itself you know, requires registrars to be able to reach one another with transfer issues, problems, complaints, etc. So this is the way we make it available for you to have access to any other registrar's transfer contact.
UDRP contact, this is the contact that will be used by ICANN or the UDRP provider to send the related notices. And as such, the contact is shared with the domain name dispute resolution providers. They also have received a radar account from which they will be able to see a list, like you can see the list with the transfer contact. Their interface is just a bit different and will show them the UDRP contact details for all registrars. Since you have to comply with the UDRP, it is very important that you always keep it up to date in order to make sure to receive every notice when a UDRP, for example, is started or when the panel has rendered the decision.
This kind of goes back to what James was saying earlier. This is a really good example of a field that you can use if you want to have a dedicated email address or dedicated person or position in the company for handling UDRP, because the dispute resolution, WIPO, NAF, ADN, DRC all get have access to this list. It's the only, I mean, they don't get all of the information in Radar, but they get the information about the UDRP contact. So that's what they will use to contact your registrar when a case is filed.
WHOIS contact, which will be used for any issue related to the WHOIS data, and this is the contact to which the WHOIS data problem report form is linked. So when you use that form on the internic.net website, the script behind will check via which registrar the domain name you have an issue with is registered and will forward the report submission to the concerned registrar's WHOIS contact. Another reason for which you always have to keep it up to date, because if you receive notice of any inaccuracy, you have to take the necessary steps to correct the problem. Now I'm also going to show you how to request to add the TLD to your accreditation, especially that you will have to do it a few times in the future for the new GTLDs once some of them starts to be there. So in the right table, you have one of the links which is called GTLDs. And if you click on it, you will see this window where you can cross the GTLDs you want to add. Then if you already choose some of them before and it hasn't been completed yet, you will see the message pending request.
But the ones we have right now are checked.
Yes, they are already checked. For example, here, that test registrar is accredited under .iro.
That sounds like a reasonable example.
Only .iro.
Exactly.
But they've requested COM and museum.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, right.
And org. So now,
could you?
Yeah.
How do you ID accumulate TLDs? Can you just
microphone so that people remotely can.
Chris Siegmann from InternetWire. How do I deactivate GTLDs in the list?
Uncheck. So he doesn't want to be listed anymore.
Yeah, in that case, you would have to send us an official notice. There's no option here to ask for the deactivation. The reason why it was made like that is that once you have crossed and saved the request, it's going to send us an automatic message so that we create the appendix for the concerned GTLD that you have to sign and send back to us. If you want to deactivate the domain name, there's no document you have to send you. That's why there's no tool here to ask for the deactivation. So you just have to send us an email in the beginning, and then we will tell you to send us an official letter requesting the domain name, the TLD to be removed. Now, another reason is that you don't remove a TLD the same way as you activate one. If you don't have any domain name registered under that TLD, it won't be a problem. We will receive the request and we will remove it and notify the registry. But if you have any domain names registered under that TLD, we have to start a transition procedure in order to bulk transfer the domain names under that GTLD to a recipient registrar, which in most of the time you will choose.
I'd like to add one thing too, and that is that you can have appendices in any or all of the TLDs with ICANN, and once we approve your accreditation, you will immediately be listed on the websites as having those TLDs. That does not mean that you've signed an RRA with the registry involved. So in other words, we're going to show, you know, as soon as you get accredited, we're going to show the TLDs you've told us you want. And so theoretically, customers could go online and say, hey, I'm going to use this registrar. They have .arrow. But you may not actually have a contract yet with the registry. So, you know, that's sort of up to you. You know, that's a separate step between you and the registry. But we don't wait to find out whether or not you've gotten a signed contract with the registry before we list it on, you know, with your name. So, but the question about removal, I, with the possible exception of some companies that are, you know, getting out of the business or transferring names away, we rarely get a request to remove a TLD, but we certainly could do that.
I'm just thinking with all the new GTLDs coming up, you know, it might be that you decide at a later stage that you're going to kick some out if they don't sell well or if you don't have any at all.
But by default, when new GTLD comes, it will be made available there, and then you will pick up the one you are interested in. And as you said, for any reason later, if you don't think they are interesting for you, you will always have that possibility.
Your mother's name, no, father.
All right.
So this is in the left table. You go under My Profile. So that one is to show your user detail. And that's where Christian would probably still see the former primary contact. Then, with regard to the users, you have the options, manage users and create users, which will allow the registrar to create these further accounts. So create user, you have to choose a password to fill in all information. Yes?
I was going to ask, sorry, my name's Rex Wickham from Imperial Registrations. Do the other users, can you say this person can only update the billing contact and not any of the other contacts?
Ask the question.
If you create other users, can you limit them to doing particular updates? So that, you let your billing department have a login, but they can only update the billing contact.
It's not available yet, but that's a very interesting point.
Like the RIPE, for example, has it?
Yeah, it's someone who could just update the billing contact, as you said. No, it's.
I thought that's the whole reason why you would have other users, was that they would be limited to roles, within the system. Otherwise, why bother having other users?
Well,
they can all do everything. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and there's another situation in which I would think it would be relevant. It's for a group of registrars, so with multiple accreditations. Then a user could be, for example, able to update just a certain registrar or certain registrars in the group, but not the other one. That could be such a feature. And especially for the registrars that have multiple companies with multiple accreditations, you have a batch change tool on the bottom left, where you will be able to update, to make bulk change to your different registrars. It's not possible to do every kind of bulk change, but for example, if you want to put the same billing contact with the same contact details to all registrars of your group or to some of the registrars, so you will pick up the registrars with the two choice above, you update the registrar list, and then you will see the list with a checkbox next to each registrar, and you will choose the registrar to which you want to apply the update. And thanks to that, you will not need to go to each registrar account and do the change individually. No, any other question? Search registrar, so it's linked to all registrars. There's a WHOIS utility, including which is not limited to the search of GTLD domain names. I did some tests on some CCTLD; it's working as well. So it's always practical to have that under the hand.
Mm-hmm. And show the we have the whitelist option.
Whitelist
of the IP addresses.
Is that on the profile?
Yeah.
No, go to just go to the main. So
we had a request for this from several registrars some time ago, and so we built this in because you know, for example, when you're trying to do a transfer and some registrars have rate limiting on their WHOIS lookups, for example. And so we have an option here for registrars to list their IP addresses so that other registrars can whitelist those IP addresses for their lookup tools. I don't know how many people are taking advantage of that, but here you could populate your IP addresses. And then if you click on View All Registrars, you can get a view or you can download it as a CSV, and it will show for those registrars that have actually completed it, it will show their IP addresses. So you know, good corporate citizens would take those and whitelist them for their WHOIS lookups.
What are the bads?
They ignore it.
Just also click on languages.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea and a feature that we really need to publicize, David, and get folks using that. You know, I don't know how to say this gently, but just our normal traffic load looks like abuse to a lot of folks' rate limiting systems, and we run into this quite a bit. And you know, I think we can commit to... I will go back right now, you know, when we get finished with Brussels, and make sure that we get that into our systems, our rate limiting systems, and that we update that, you know, as frequently as practical.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, James. I think that's an excellent point, and we can probably I think we'll try to put a couple targeted articles into the next newsletter, you know, telling people how to do it and why they should do it. You know, our registrar newsletter, and you know, maybe there'll be other places or opportunities we can do to communicate that as well.
I think you just can't tell that story enough, and you know, if we can get folks using that, I think that would be great. Anything we can do, even up to the point of, you know, this is something I think is interesting subject matter for an advisory, as opposed to some of the things that come out as advisories. But, you know, that's very important, and operationally I'm sure that everybody in this room has had that headache where they're trying to process a transfer, and it's just not going through for thin registries.
Yes?
Yeah. James, that's a great point. And contractual compliance will add that, you know, this information in our quarterly newsletter, and I'll take your suggestion on advisory under strong consideration. You bet.
Well, that raises an interesting point, which is, are registrars contractually obligated to use Radar and keep their information in there and maintain it under a certain schedule? And, I'm just asking that question because I don't know.
You know, there is a limit to the, you know, the obligation, but, you know, and that's where we always get into some fine points with regard to who is limiting, too, because registrars are contractually required to prevent abuse of their WHOIS as well. So, you know, the whole concept of whitelisting for other registrars for transfer purposes is fine, but they also sort of have an obligation to make sure that doesn't get abused. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But you know, we can look more closely at what the obligation really is. There is an obligation to maintain accurate information, especially in the 2009 RAA, but it doesn't single out Radar as the way to do that. Incidentally, we are making some additions and revisions to Radar, and shortly we're going to be releasing a new version that also has a directors and officers field, because there is an obligation under the 2009 RAA that registrars report their directors and officers to ICANN and report changes to those registrars and, you know, officers when they occur. And so we haven't aggressively started enforcing that provision, because we hadn't created the right mechanism for you to communicate that to us. So once we have it up in Radar, again, this is going to be something that registrars are going to be asked to do, is to complete that information there and then maintain it. So that you'll be seeing that coming out soon too.
So this is the language link on the right, where you can add or remove the languages in which your registrar provides support.
It's important to maintain this with all of the languages you support, because those languages do get listed on the InterNIC website. So when your registrar is listed there, it will also list what languages you said you support. So theoretically, customers around the world can go to that lookup and say, okay, you know, I want a registrar that I can do business with in Swahili or, you know, Chinese or what have you. And so they can search by the language that you support. So it's important. This is a good place for you to be sure to complete that information so that customers will be able to find you.
Any
might be stuck here.
Uh-oh. Oh. Another link you have on the right, it's the port 43 Whois URL. It will not determine, it's to put your registrar's Whois server, it will not determine the Whois server that will appear in VeriSigns, Whois results when people search for a domain name. This is something you will determine with VeriSign, but the list of all registrars will be able to see will include that Whois server, so it may be practical for another registrar for some reasons to see what your Whois server is. And description and logo, so you can upload your logo there under and put a brief description of your registrar's activities, which will appear on the InterNIC, on the registrar list on internic.net.
And then you can preview it.
Yeah, preview what it's going to look like.
Yes. And be careful that the InterNIC website is refreshed once per day. So don't be surprised if you don't see the information directly appearing on the real InterNIC website, which is the reason why such a preview was created. Any other question?
And I'm just showing here also there's this feature that lets you see the change history. So if you've got multiple users on one account, you could see what changes were made and by whom.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm not trying to be provocative here, but the login seems a bit basic in some ways. Is the username is predictable because you can look it up, so there's only a matter of trying many passwords and you could get in somebody else's account.
I know what you're saying. We debated, you know, at one point we were thinking about giving out you know, RSA keys or something else, but then we you know, we discussed it with registrars. We asked them, this was before you were involved, but we asked the registrar group, you know, what kind of security they thought would be appropriate. And And it was their belief, they informed us that they didn't think the security needed to be all that robust as long as notices were sent to the primary contact for every change that was made. So, and you can't log in and change the primary contact. So even if someone could theoretically log in as you on their, they could change the billing contact, they could change the Whois contact, but you know, the fact of the matter is you would immediately get notice that that had been changed and you would be able to say, hey, what's going on here? And then go in and, you know, alter the password. So I think we did a trade-off of less rigid login requirements, but better tracking of the changes made. So if you're... if you've got no more questions right now about Radar, we're going to move into the training program session. Mike is going to present what our training program is, the look and feel, and some background, and get some input from you. James, you have to go to something else.
Yeah, I found out I just have a little bit more time. So
great. Well, we'd love to have you here.
I'm learning with the rest of them. So.
Although we won't be starting until 10 o'clock.
Right. Okay.
Because other people aren't, you know, aren't going to log in or aren't expecting to come here till 10, so.
Yeah. Tim, just, you know, more overarching kind of questions about Radar. I mean, how frequently would you say this is used? Or how widespread is this in use? I mean, I think that you guys have built a pretty important tool, and I just want to make sure that folks are aware of it and that it's working. And I don't want to assume that just because this is my first exposure to it that, you know, it's in the shadows or something like that.
Something I can tell you is that I have recently received a lot of primary contact updates, which means that the concerned registrars have gone into the Radar account and checked their information. I could have noticed in the past that some registrars had not been there for a long time, but this is a situation that has decreased a lot. It's more and more seldom when I still meet that situation when I check the change history, and the number of update requests has strongly increased, which is a good sign, of course.
Yeah, we did some checking a while back. This is actually over a year ago, and we determined that well over 90%. Of the registrars had logged in and modified their login, because when we send out your login and password, the first thing you have to do is when you log in is to change the password. So you know, we give you a password and then you have to log in and change it. So we can tell at least how many registrars have done that. You know, how many are actively using it on a day-to-day basis, I think it really varies, but we've tried to build enough benefits into it. You know, for example, being able to list the languages, being able to get your transfer contacts, being able to do the whitelisting. You know, we've tried to build enough benefits into it that encourage people to get familiar with it and to use it. But, you know, it's the kind of thing we can't make them do it. But on the other hand, I think more and more we're seeing people using it. So while we're waiting for 10 o'clock to roll around and Mike to get started, why don't we? There's some new faces in the room, and maybe we could go around and just introduce ourselves and tell everybody else where you're from, because I think that's always a helpful thing. And of course, I'm Tim Cole from ICANN.
Hi, I'm Tom Stenson from the UK2 group in London.
I'm Rob Coghill from Askio Technologies, Netnames, and various other brands in the UK, Denmark, and around the world.
Hi, I'm Matt Serlin from Market Monitor in the United States.
I'm Mohamed Diop from Senegal, West Africa, from Kewell.com.
I'm Nikweno from Ghana, Ghana.com.
I'm Alan Barnett from Imperial Registrations, and I'm from London.
I'm Hayat Hussein from Cum Laude in London.
I'm James Bladel from GoDaddy in the US.
I'm Rex Wickham from Imperial Registrations.
And you need how to learn to use the microphone, I guess. My name is Christian. You always talk like this, and then it doesn't help that much. Sorry. And my name is Christian Müller from Strato, from or Kronon, actually, is the name, the membership name, from Berlin. And I have to leave in about 10 minutes, sorry.
And I'm Steve Gobin from ICANN.
right. I think we're a little past 10 o'clock, so I think we're okay to start. I want to say thanks for sticking around, or thanks for coming, if that's the case. I'm Mike Zupke. I'm a Registrar Liaison Manager for ICANN, based in the Marina Del Rey office. And I really appreciate you guys coming here and taking the time to talk a little bit with us about the Registrar Training Program that we've been working on for a good number of months now. Steve, would you mind just closing the door, please? Thanks. So here's the really short, simple agenda. I promise it's really not going to be too bad. You know, just give you a little bit of background, talk to you about some of the feedback that we've heard from registrars so far, give you some of the ideas of what we're looking for, and then give you a demonstration of what we've been working on. Hopefully, you know, I hope that you'll like it, but, you know, to the extent you've got feedback, we're happy to hear it, and Steve's got his notepad ready. He's going to take notes and make get any comments that you've got so that we are able to incorporate any feedback that you give us. All right, so I thought I was going to be able to do this on both screens at once, but I'm not that coordinated, so I'm gonna get some neck exercise today looking at my slides. So just as background about the Registrar Training Program, so those who were involved in the negotiation of the 2009 RAA probably know that the 2009 version of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement has a provision that requires all registrars to undergo some form of operator skills training, which is really, if you look at what the RAA says, the Registrar Accreditation Agreement says that it's basically about the accreditation agreement's obligations and consensus policies. So that's what it is, and the agreement also says that the program should be developed in consultation with registrars, and that ICANN should offer this course free of charge to registrars in some online format. So that's what we've endeavored to do. We've begun creating this online tutorial. We started right now with a unit on the transfer policy, which is what we're going to demo for you today. So that's where we are. We had a session in Seoul at the ICANN meeting. We had a session in Nairobi. And we had a session by teleconference following, was that after the Seoul meeting? Or
Between Seoul and Nairobi.
So we've had already three consultations with registrars, and this one I think is probably the last really big one before you get to see at least the beta version of the finished product. At this point we've really, we're pretty well along the way in developing the module on the transfer policy, but the rest of them are still pretty early, so we're still at a good point to accept any feedback that you may have. So to date, let me just give you a quick overview of what the course will include. We've got a unit, as I mentioned, on the inter-registrar transfer policy. We're going to talk a bit about who is, both availability of who is and obligations related to accuracy of who is. We're going to talk about the data escrow obligations and other things related to data, such as data retention, some of the obligations that are data collection and privacy, that sort of thing. We'll talk about the uniform domain name dispute resolution policy. And we've got a couple of sort of catch-all categories. One is what we're calling dealings with registrants, and that's things like the sorts of things registrars are required to tell their customers, the things that the customers are required to tell their registrar. And finally, we've got just some kind of miscellaneous administrative things, such as introductory materials, background about ICANN, and also how to interact with ICANN, how to do things like work radar, how to change your contacts, add TLDs, that sort of thing. So here's what we've received to date, and I've broken this down by form, substance, and administration of the training program. And so if you look, what we've heard, something that was emphasized very strongly to us from several registrars was that we need to be supportive of multiple languages. And I think that it's often a complaint by registrars that they feel that they're complying, but the other registrar isn't, and that either puts them at a competitive disadvantage or really inhibits their ability to do business under, say, the transfer policy. So one of the ways that we thought we would do that is to, make sure that we've got multiple translations. And one of the questions that I'll be asking you today is, what languages should we be supporting? Another comment that we heard from registrars was that they would like for the course to be modular, so that if they want to retake a section or refer back to a section, or if maybe they would like to have one of their employees look at a particular section but not the entire program, that they would be able to do that. So we're certainly building that in. We've heard from registrars that, you know, the thing should have good value for learning. They want people to feel like they remember stuff, that they're retaining the course materials. And the way that seemed obvious to do that was to put, you know, some sort of tests or quizzes throughout the program, have maybe reflection points so that people can reflect on what they're learning. So, you know, of course, we'll build that in. Another comment that we heard was that it shouldn't be necessarily just a one-time sit-down, take the course, and be done type of a course. People would like maybe reference materials like a checklist about the transfer policy. What are the, you know, seven things I need to remember if I'm the gaining registrar? If it's a UDRP, what order do things need to happen, and what's the schedule for those things? So we want to provide lots of takeaways, and we'll probably do that as mostly PDF documents, so people who are more comfortable printing it can print it, or if you want to save it and live in the digital world, you'll be free to do that. People have asked for some case studies, and to the extent that we can make up some fictional but realistic case studies, we'll try to do that. I think what you'll see in the training is probably more technically referred to as scenarios. So in some of the quiz materials, we'll say, you know, suppose this is the scenario. What's the appropriate course of action? What's the appropriate response? And finally, one of the questions that we asked was if there was any interest in having perhaps a monthly webinar or a weekly sort of thing, or having courses live at the ICANN meetings. And I thought, you know, I was sort of enthused about that, and I got a lot of silence to that. So it sounded like there wasn't interest in it, and I think one of the concerns that we heard was that people said, you know, I don't want to be obligated to attend an ICANN meeting. I don't want to be obligated to call you during a time that might not be convenient to me. And that wasn't really the intention. We thought these would be recorded sessions that people could review any time. But, to me, I thought the value was if something's not clear, you can ask questions and you can follow up and you can have a dialogue. You know, we can have a chat room as we usually do in the Adobe Connect rooms. But it just sounded like the voice that we heard was, you know, put your efforts into creating this once now, and, you know, make sure that it's expandable in the future, but it shouldn't be an ongoing effort by ICANN. So we heard that, and I think that's the way forward, although as an independent initiative, we might take that on if there were interest, maybe having a periodic webinar or, you know, whatever it might be. And of course, we always do have workshops at the ICANN meeting, such as the one that Steve did this morning about using radar. In terms of substance, the thing that I heard the most was the transfer policy is really important to us. And I said, okay, what else? And they said, well, the transfer policy. And I said, okay, give me one more thing. The transfer policy. So obviously, you know, this has a very competitive, it's a very strong impact on registrars' competition. So, that's one of the reasons why we want to demo that for you today, so that you know that what we're doing is hopefully going to be worthwhile for you. We heard requests that we use real examples, and I think that, I guess, you know, that's kind of loaded depending on how real you want to be. I think to the extent that we're, you know, naming names and using real domain names and, I don't know that we'll be doing that, but we there's still a potential we might refer to breach letters that got posted. The idea is that this isn't really a shaming tool, and it also should hopefully withstand the test of time so that something that seemed like a big deal yesterday but kind of fades into our memories doesn't necessarily have to, live on the front page forever. another piece of feedback that we heard, so we asked registrars, do you want background about ICANN, the history, the way it works, how policy development works? And in general, the feedback that we got was, keep that short. You know, just give us the stuff that we're required to know to do our business, and that's where we want the most of our time. Having said that, you know, we won't be stymied. we want at least make available materials that will be helpful to people, because I know, for example, the registrar constituency is always looking to generate more interest in membership, and so to the extent that we can help people to become involved in the policy-making community, you know, we want to do that, and we see that as part of our job. And so, you know, I think the compromise there is that we'll provide some optional materials, and you know, to the extent that this is important to registrars, we'll try not to expend a lot of resources or energy on that area, but really focus on the parts that are important to registrars, and that's RAA and consensus policy compliance. So a couple other points that we got. One was that you know, we've got over 99% of registrars now, I think, on board with the data escrow program. We've got something like 99.5% of all GTLD domain names covered by the data escrow program. And yet people still complain, you know, it was really hard getting on board, and we, you know, think that there would be good benefit to people in having, you know, a good, simple, plain English guide to what is it I need to do and, you know, where are the forms. And so we've committed to doing that, and I think that we don't want to necessarily belabor the point in this training program, because it really, I think, in a lot of people's minds is a one-time thing. You know, you set up your scripts, you know, set up a cron job, and you know, you'll be compliant with your data escrow obligations for the rest of, you know, for the rest of eternity. But well, you know, what we heard from that was maybe ICANN can publish some good onboarding materials, some real plain language stuff. We could post it on the site and maybe reference it in this and say, if you've got further questions, here's a resource that'll be available to you. So we definitely heard that, and I think that to the extent anybody's got feedback today, you know, if it's not strictly related to this course, you know, we're happy to take that and try and improve other processes if we can. You know, and I didn't really talk about how this is supposed to work so much, but I should say, feel free to interrupt me if you've got any questions. I don't mean to make you listen to my voice for this entire this entire time. So by all means, you know, please do so. Finally, in terms of administration, we had, you know, I was very happy to hear that registrars are taking this seriously and that they want it to be effective as a good tool for ensuring compliance in the you know, registration marketplace. One of the comments that we heard was that registrars said, you know, it shouldn't be a one-time course. It should happen in some repeated fashion, and maybe a registrar doesn't have to take the entire course every year, or, you know, even necessarily every 5 years, but there should be some sort of refresher. And, you know, one of the things that seemed somewhat logical, I guess, was that every accreditation agreement, at least, you know, in theory, renews every 5 years. Maybe that would be the time that we say, okay, it's you know, you're due for your refresher course. A suggestion was made that we coordinate with the registries, who apparently also offer webinars at times, and I think that, you know, we're happy to try and do that. I think, as a practical matter, if their stuff is kind of on this recurring or ongoing basis, it might be a little bit harder for us to coordinate their and our training efforts, since ours will be more of a one-time thing and theirs will be more recurring. But I think that what I learned or what I heard from that was that you know, we might be able to be a good communication tool for registries, since we do publish a periodic newsletter. We might be able to help advertise those sorts of things. Although, you know, to a certain extent, you know, right, registries have a competitive marketplace just like registrars do. And if they want registrars to sell their domains, then, you know, perhaps they need to be aggressive in making sure that you're aware of it and able to do it. So I think, you know, we're not trying to clutter our newsletter up with advertisements for TLDs, but I think that to the extent that we can be helpful, you know, we're happy to do that. And in fact, at the regional gatherings that ICANN holds, registries do typically give presentations about, you know, new developments or things that are going on. And so I'm sure that that sort of thing may, you know, continue as a possible way to facilitate outreach. And finally, and this is something that I would today like to still get more clarification about from the people in this room, is to what extent registrars want certification through this program. You know, it's one thing to say, I took this course because I was required to. It might be another thing to say, you know, at least I don't know about the rest of the world, but in the U.S., certain car dealerships say they've got the Mr. Goodwrench certification, and they proudly, you know, put that sign on the wall. And so to the extent that you'd like to, you know, have a Mr. Goodwrench or Mr. Good Digits or whatever it's going to be, Mr. Good TLD, to the extent that we can provide something like that, we're open to hearing that. One of the things that we've been sort of thinking about, and it wasn't, you know, I'm not sure how expressly this was stated before, but you'll see that this is one of our questions coming up, is, you know, would registrars like their employees to get certified? You know, as a registrar, only one person at your company is going to be required to take the course, but if you've got a customer service department that works mostly in transfers, you know, would you like to offer your employees the opportunity to get certified as a, you know, IRTP, you know, learned scholar, or what, you know, if that's something that's, you know, of interest to you, it's probably at this point in our development a fairly minimally costly thing for us to do, and so let us know, and we'll build it in. What I've learned through doing this is that, on the back end, once you sign up for you know somebody to host your learning software, your learning suite, everything else is pretty much included. So, you know, it's really just a matter of us thinking to do it up front so that we're not, you know, trying to modify a lot of things as we go. So, you know, give us whatever feedback you've got. You know, I mean, that's why we're here. So, yeah, go ahead.
If you're wanting feedback, I think it's definitely a good idea to allow different teams to sort of train up on different processes. Ultimately, it's not so much about sort of having a certificate for these guys. Maybe we can do that. But it's just so that they get the process right. And if, you know, a lot of the processes, the documentation, it's pretty obscure at the moment. Pretty hard to get into. It's very inaccessible. So the more people that understand it, then the less problems there's going to be, the better registrars will work together, the better experience the registrants will get, because when they contact a registrar, they won't be passed around between staff departments as they're trying to scrabble for the answer. So it just improves the experience for everyone all around. So to me, it's a no-brainer, really.
Thanks. You know, and as you mentioned it, it occurs to me, one of the things that registrars previously told us that they wanted was, you know, a short section on how to navigate the ICANN website. You know, so that's definitely on the roadmap. You know, is one of the things I think. Hopefully, that kind of addresses what you're looking for too. That, you know, all of these things. You know, when registrars email me or call me and have a question, I say, yeah, you know, I'm happy to help you. Of course, it's on the website, and of course, you can't find it because it's somewhere out there. So you know, I think that having that would be a good thing, and I think that also might be one of those things that we pull out of the training course and maybe have a takeaway that, you know, either goes in the newsletter, or maybe, you know, we find a good front and center location on our website and we say, here's the, you know, registrar resources page, or the registrar 101, or what, you know, whatever it is. We'll have a page where you know, you'll know either all the information will be there, or it will tell you how to find anything that you're looking for. So I hope that will be a good outcome from this. Right. So today we're gonna give you, a draft version of the entire transfer policy module done, but it's about 29 minutes and it's still in fairly rough form. So I won't make you sit through the whole thing unless you really get excited by that sort of thing. But I'll give you a little clip of it, and here's kind of the feedback that we're looking for. And after I show you the clip, I'll put this up again so that you know. But I just thought before I show it, I'll kind of give you insight. But this is think of it as a free for all. We're open to everything. These are some of the things that I thought were maybe some somewhat unanswered questions that we have. So to the extent that you have any particular insight on these, I would encourage you to think in these areas. So any other questions before I try to make this thing work? Yeah. Please.
Mohammed from Kewal, okay. I have two questions and one remark. The first question is, do you think that by making available in different languages, we can reduce many behavior that are due to lack of knowledge from many actors in the registrar business? Because 900 is not a small number, and we... we represent a large number of in the community of the constituency, and I think that the whole discussion we already have regarding making available resources in different language to make information available, especially in areas where we know that awareness is a big issue, training is a big issue. When we try to train people in the registrar business, we don't have any institution available for that. So we're really struggling to get our team trained in order to get the skills. So if you add to that technical problem, the language barrier is going to be another headache as well. So I think that making training available through webinar, through some video online session or whatever you can, and but adding translation might be really appropriate. To the question of additional fee, I think that is not an issue because this is part of the functioning of the whole ICANN organization, and I think that it's one of their duty to be sure that all the constituents are getting the right information at the right time. So I'm not saying any additional cost to be added for that because it's part of what I call the responsibility of ICANN to make these things work, so make information available and be sure that people are not lacking appropriate information in their languages in order to be performing well. So that's really my thought.
Thank you for those. You know, I think those are both really two very good points. And so, I wholeheartedly agree with you on the language thing. I think that, lack of knowledge or lack of understanding is probably a big problem in certain, in certain parts because, as you say, almost all of the compliance materials are in English or English exclusively. And in fact, the contract is in English. And so I think anything we can do to improve understanding, we should. And when we first started this, people said, translation is really important. I said, I hear you, and I think, to the extent that we can do it cost-effectively, we will. And my research now has shown that I think we can do it very cost-effectively. So, the question now is how many languages, what are the languages? And I think that, that we definitely want to, pursue that in as many as make sense. So I agree. And on the second point,
can you, before you move on that point, sure, on the language, I think that we don't have to do something specific out of what ICANN is trying to do. I think that for the strategic planning, for all these documents we're trying to make a large awareness among the community, we have tried to translate it into some languages that have been adopted. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can follow the same trend. I'm not asking for just the 6,000 languages, but look at how many languages have been translated for the strategic plan and all the other documents and the website of ICANN. So it's going to be a good start. So just show that there was a willingness of trying to help people understand what we're talking about because, the number of registrants behind the registrar, if you take you add all of them, it's a huge community that really need to get accurate information and understandable information in order to make things work.
Thanks. That's a good point. And I saw Steve made a note of that, so that's great. And I was thinking also, besides what ICANN, the larger entity is doing, I think, we'll probably also look at where the registrars are located and make sure that we're also covering any areas that maybe happen to have a large concentration of registrars in the event that they're not already covered in that kind of broader body that you were just talking about. I do want to just make and I probably should have explained this before I put it up here because whenever you talk about charging money, you have to be careful. So the course will be free to registrars, and what the accreditation agreement says is the registrar's either the registrar's primary contact, who is the person listed in the agreement, or some designee who is an employee of the registrar is required to take the course. So that person could take it for free. But we've got a lot of registrars telling us, I might want more people in my company doing it. And so we're kind of looking at, how do we do that in a way that's also consistent with the pricing model that we'll be required to pay for when we host the course. So I think we're already committed to somehow making this available to registrar employees who aren't necessarily the required attendees. It's more a question of how we do it. And there's some kind of logistical benefits and also some drawbacks from different ways that we might do it. So, one option could be we could convert the entire course to just a flash unit and host it on our own site and people could view it. One of the drawbacks is, as you'll see, there's some functionality in the course for people to take quizzes and to have questions that they have to answer in order to continue. That stuff doesn't work real well in Flash if you just host it as a Flash file. So the question, we could just give everybody access to the one that we'll host professionally, and they could take the quizzes, and they would get the full benefit of it. From what I understand, there may be about a $4 to $5 per person cost to do that. If it ends up being a couple hundred people, that's not a huge deal. If it ends up being 10,000, it's a little bit bigger deal. So, I just want a sort of a feel for what people think. If we asked registrars, would you be willing to pay $5 per employee to do this? If everybody says, we think ICANN should just pay it, I'll take that back to management and say, we just might need to budget a little bit more money for this. And I think that's perfectly fair. I just, ultimately registrars are, it's your money one way or another. So, so that's the question. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I guess my opinion of that would be, I think ICANN should pay for up to 10,000 people in a company for every accredited registrar. I think that's probably a fair number, because I mean maybe it's not 10,000, maybe it's 1,000, but I think it ought to be a pretty damn high number. Sorry, and especially if it's costing you $4 or $5, I think you'd get the sense from registrars that we've got enough fees built into the system for ICANN to absorb the cost for. Maybe it's 1,000 employees. I don't know what it is, but that would be my sense. And again, I'm just speaking. Well, I'm speaking actually on behalf of Mark Monitor in that comment, but not on behalf of the stakeholder group or anything. But I don't know if other registrars want to share thoughts or not. But
okay, thank you.
Just to be in the line of what is in the contract, you say that okay, there was a number of people inside the company that initially need to be trained, but if you take into consideration the high turnover in the personnel, so you really have to think about what's going to happen if the people who are initially trained move from one registrar to another, and is that going to be reconsidered every time that people need to have, whenever you don't have people who got that training and you're still running the business, so what are you going to do? Are you going to pay, or is that going to be mandatory every time that you will no longer have resources inside who are not able to have such training under operation?
Yeah, that's a good point. I might just have to give that some thought. I think it would be no problem for ICANN to just pay it. I don't think it'd be an issue. I think, it will be something we'll just automate in our process, and I think it shouldn't be a problem. Any other? Yeah.
This is probably a reason why you want to train more than one person in each organization. Just train a handful, and that will help when you have staff turnover, so that there's always someone in the organization that knows what's going on and aware of the procedures. And also, registrars have no intention of abusing this, getting everyone trained up, because obviously there's a cost to us with our staff time. Going to school probably isn't the most fun thing anyhow. So.
Oh, we're going to make it fun.
Oh, great.
Just to add on that, the Swedish have a really good model whereby in each registrar they have to train two people at one time. So if one leaves, there's always somebody and it overlaps. So something like that would solve the problem if somebody leaves. And I don't think we should pay. I think I agree with Mark Monitor.
All right, thank you. Any other comments on that before we do the demo? Yeah.
I'll just make a quick comment. What would be the cost of actually collecting five dollars. I mean, that is the, you know, in my experience, you know, that it could be 10 times as much to collect $5.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't want ICANN doing that. but what I've been informed by the hosting provider is that, you know, they could put a commerce page on there where they would just collect the fee, whether it's a credit card or PayPal or something. And, you know, I said, just the optics of that, you know, make me cringe. You know, I could just see, you know, when a registrar signs up for this course. And I could imagine, you know, if you've got a customer service department with, you know, a couple hundred or you know, close to 1,000 people, you know, do you have to issue a credit card to every single employee? You know, that could be pretty problematic. And, in fact, you know, we're still in negotiations with our most likely hosting provider. And, you know, I've expressed this to them that that would probably be a pretty inconvenient thing, and that what we really, you know, what I've been pushing for is for them just to commit to a flat fee for unlimited use. And, you know, it sounds like that's not really their model, but, you know, I can, you know, stomp my feet, I guess, and pound my fist. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you know, $4 a person isn't a huge amount of money. So I think, you know, I'm sure we can come to a good way to do that. That'll be, you know, as you say, reasonably convenient.
Hey, Mike, on a slightly different topic, you know, obviously you guys are in the registrar liaison office, but it strikes me, I wonder if you guys have reviewed the materials or the proposed materials with the contractual compliance folks, and if they've sort of, you know, looked at it in from their perspective in terms of the complaints that they see and the compliance issues that they see, to make sure that the training materials that you guys are putting together kind of track to the issues that they see on their side. So just wondering if there's been kind of collaboration with those folks.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've had the compliance team take a look at our starting outline and then kind of the enhanced outline. And so, you know, we definitely have had their input in it. So we're trying to focus on what's, you know, really the important stuff versus, you know, what's just a bunch of words in the agreement that, you know, may never actually have a lot of significance to a lot of people. And, you know, and in doing this, you know, where we started was we just took the RAA line by line and said, okay, you know, in or out. And, you know, we started with, you know, almost everything was in. And then I said, okay. You know, and then I gave it to the compliance team, and they said, oh, you missed a few, you know, so we got some more in. And then we went through and started writing the script and said, oh, this is just way too much stuff. So, you know, we ended up pulling a lot of things out. And so, you know, when I first started this, I thought, wow, this could be a one-week boot camp, you know. And so I think right now we're estimating we're probably looking at about a total of 3 hours worth of material. So I think, you know, a registrar who you know, wanted to get it over with could do it in a week pretty painlessly.
You know, you mentioned the boot camp, but I don't know if maybe we had talked about this in Nairobi, but have we talked through sort of the notion of doing, you know, maybe an annual in-person, you know, one in Brussels, one in Marina Del Rey, one, you know, Asia Pacific, actual in-person classroom training, and then this would be viewed sort of as supplemental, or, you know, be able to have the online piece available too? Because I think an in-person classroom training, you know, could have a lot more benefits.
Yeah, I personally like that idea. You know, I didn't hear a lot of resonance for it, but I, you know, since you sound supportive of it, I'm going to put you down in the in favor column. and I think if this is what the registrars want, I think, you know, I love getting up here. You know, I'll come to every ICANN meeting and do something. You know, so I'm happy to do that. And maybe, you know, what it is, it's not the big full-blown, the big show. Maybe it's, you know, we found from compliance that, you know, right now the UDRP is a big source of problems, and we'll spend, you know, 45 minutes just going through the kind of the outline of it and then answering questions and hopefully trying to resolve issues that way. I'm happy to do that. Or, you know, maybe I'm kind of stepping on compliance turf. I don't know. Maybe that's something they would prefer to do. Okay, any other...
Mike? Yeah. I think that, well, if we move on to training format, I think that it will be, we should really consider the number of registrars who are not rich enough to afford going for training and getting dedicated staff for over 1 week for that live training. So I think that getting the two format, the webinar one for people who don't want to spend, because 3 hours is not enough justification to travel from one country to another or And I think that you really need to consider that. So I think that we need to take into consideration two things. The first one is the format of the training we want, the thematic that we want to debate, because sometimes people don't want to spend the whole hours in different topics. Some of them are more legal. Some others want to deal more with the other topics than really the others. So I think that we really need to slice them in a WebEx format with different thematic in the registrar agreement. And the other one is the language issue, because we really need to look at if there is an issue getting a WebEx format in French, in Arabic, in English. Maybe the cost of implementing this type of training will be much lower than trying to dedicate. It doesn't prevent what Mark Monitor is suggesting as a live format during the ICANN meeting or something like that. But at least try to make it as an usual case that webinar in different languages and for different thematic, slice it, make it available for people, will help much more people who are not very easy to move than trying to come to this meeting to get that training. So that's my suggestion.
Okay, thank you. You know, and you know, if you look at what the accreditation agreement says, it requires that we provide it online. So at the very least, you know, we can't make you do more than you know what's provided online. And I definitely hear your point about the translations.
Hey, Mike, just a point of clarification. Yeah, absolutely. I'm 100% in agreement that this should be available online in a variety of languages. I guess what I was saying, supplemental to that. Let's look at maybe doing, you know, if it's once a year, twice a year, whatever it is. So, yeah, agreed.
Okay. Any other? Okay. Great. So this would just take me a second here to get this all loaded up. And I promise I did practice this morning, so it shouldn't be too painful, but just give me a second. Where's my mouse? And you know, before I start, I'll just forewarn you that the way that we're presenting this today is using a tool that's designed for people to get kind of a proof of concept look at this. There are a few little idiosyncrasies in how it'll display on the screen. For example, the script will also be available in words on the bottom. Occasionally, if I move the mouse, it'll cover them up, but that's only because of this platform that we're using to preview it. I promise it'll be more intuitive, more friendly when you're actually sitting down to do it. So I think with that, so if you'll have that forgiveness for me in advance, here we go.
Inter-Registrar Transfer Policy is an ICANN consensus policy that allows registrants to transfer their GTLD registrations from one ICANN-accredited registrar to another. Its purpose is to promote competition in the registrar marketplace by enabling consumer choice. At the same time, it helps ensure the stability and security of the domain name system by requiring the use of standardized registrant authorization procedures across all registrars and registries. By the end of this unit, you should understand all domain transfer procedures specified in the inter-registrar transfer policy, as well as the permissible reasons for denying outgoing transfers. You should also be familiar with the actions a registrar can take if another registrar fails to follow the policy. We'll refer to the inter-registrar transfer policy as the transfer policy, or the policy, throughout this section of the course. You can find the complete policy at ICANN.org/EN/transfers. If you like, you can keep the transfer policy open in a separate window as you move through this training. The transfer policy is generally intended to promote efficiency in the GTLD marketplace. Good communication helps ensure that efficiency. ICANN asks all registrars to establish and maintain a dedicated email point of contact in RADAR for resolution of transfer policy issues that may arise. In case you're unfamiliar with RADAR, it's the website registrars use to update ICANN contact information. RADAR's control panel makes it easy to keep things current. A registrar's transfer issue email address will only be used by registrars and the registries for messages pertaining to transfer requests. It's important to note that messages received at this address must be responded to within 7 calendar days. Let's take a look at a typical transfer. The process generally begins when a registrar name holder notifies a prospective gaining registrar that it wishes to initiate a transfer of a domain name it registered at a different registrar. The gaining registrar then must collect WHOIS data for the domain and should direct its customer to unlock the domain name and request an authorization code, also called an auth code or auth info code, from the registrar of record, also called a losing registrar. Using the collected WHOIS data, the gaining registrar transmits a copy of the standardized form of authorization, or FOA, to either the registrar name holder or the administrative contact for the domain. The customer authorizes the transfer by responding to the FOA and providing the auth code to the gaining registrar. Finally, the gaining registrar provides the auth code obtained from the registered name holder to the registry and requests that the registry process the transfer. Assuming the auth code is correct and the domain name is unlocked, the registry will notify both registrars that the transfer will be completed at the end of 5 days. Unless the losing registrar objects to the transfer during those 5 days, the registry will effect the transfer. Now that you've seen an overview of the entire transfer process, let's look more closely at the preliminary tasks the gaining registrar completes after a customer requests a transfer. In general, to process the transfer, the gaining registrar must identify the registered name holder through request and verification of the domain's auth info code and confirm authorization for the transfer through use of the form of authorization. These tasks can be performed concurrently or serially, as long as both are completed before initiating the transfer at the registry. As a preliminary matter, a domain name must be unlocked before it can be transferred. The transfer policy requires all registrars to provide their customers with readily accessible and reasonable means to unlock their domain names. Let's talk about auth info codes. As we mentioned previously, an auth info code is...
So I'm gonna stop it there. One thing I forgot to do was to give you the disclaimer before I showed this. So I'm gonna refer. Let's see now if I can get that back up. Okay. So the thing that I should have said before we started was that, you know, this really is just a proof of concept. It's not the final. So I don't want you to watch this and say I can rely on it because ICANN told me that's the transfer policy. I'll tell you, I personally believe it's all correct, but because we have review processes that need to happen, you know, I need to tell you that. And so there it is. But in any case, that's just a slice of the program. And the other thing that I didn't mention that I should have was that there are navigational controls in the program, but that's one more of those things that this presentation platform doesn't allow us to use. So the screen would actually stop and allow you to think about what you just saw or go back if you wanted to. But so having said that, I was going to give you one of the sample quizzes that appears during the module. So should I do a poll in the course, or would that be unfair since we didn't actually get to that part yet? I'll call that unfair. I won't. You can just have a little pride if you get it right. But all right. Can you see okay, or should I read it out loud? Well, it's harder for me to read it than it probably is for you. Okay, you want to read it? Thank you.
The sample quiz answer says maybe.
Wait, first read the question.
Oh, okay, but you got to. Here was the sample quiz question is, may a registrar require a registered name holder to appear in person in order to unlock a domain name? And the options are yes, no, or maybe. The answer is maybe. Registrars are required to provide registered nameholders with readily accessible and reasonable means to unlock their domains. In many cases, requiring a registered nameholder to appear in person to unlock its domain name might be unreasonable and would violate the transfer policy. On the other hand, a registered nameholder could request that its name only be unlocked when he or she visits the registrar's office in person. In this case, such a requirement would probably not be unreasonable.
I think that there is a language problem there in the question, because it in person doesn't mean physically.
So it might that was
mean,
the intention.
It might mean virtually authenticate.
That's a good point. So we should you know, we'll make a note to clarify that. That was the intention anyhow. So that's an example of a quiz question, you know, that we heard from registrars. We want something that's, you know, somewhat stimulating. We don't want necessarily the easy questions that everybody automatically will just know because it's obvious. We tried to, you know, put things in there that would potentially be kind of an edge case so that it would, you know, keep people kind of entertained as they go. I was accused of making that in there as a trick question. Did anybody feel that was a trick? No? Okay, good. Then we've got a smart room here. So, you know, I just posted our questions again, and I think, you know, we actually got a lot of feedback before we even showed the demo, and I think a lot of that was really valuable, and it was, you know, it was exactly the sort of thing I was looking for. But to the extent that there's, you know, more feedback, we've still got, you know, the room for another 10 minutes, so I would, you know, welcome whatever other sorts of comments you have, either about the demo itself or, you know, about other kind of areas of the training program. As I said, you know, there's still good time to shape the outcome.
Sorry if I missed a mic, but what's the timeline? What are you guys expecting to have even a beta ready to run through? And most importantly, when do you expect to have the required portion kick in?
Good questions. of course, you know, ICANN being on these trimesters, all of our staff goals are also kind of key to these trimesters. So the next, you know, big deliverable is going to happen around the time of the Cartagena meeting in December. So the idea was that maybe a couple weeks before that meeting, you know, we'll try to have a beta ready for, you know, at least internal staff testing. We'll start playing with it, trying to break it, trying to, you know, find any potential typos and that sort of thing that we might have missed along the way. And then that by Cartagena, you know, we'll have something available that we can, you know, let registrars sign up to play with, to do. We'll take that feedback, and then hopefully, you know, shortly thereafter, we'll be able to, you know, let the thing into the wild. I think, though, that realistically, probably, it'll be the English version that'll be done by that time. So we won't make it mandatory immediately. What we want to do is make sure that we've got the robust language support that we need before we, you know, tell registrars you must do this. So I think what we might do is, you know, either at the end of the year or at the very beginning of the next year, depending on, you know, people's attention cycles and attention spans, we'll put it out there and, you know, let registrars know kind of the more formalized timeline for compliance, but, you know, put it out there as something they could optionally start using if they want to incorporate it in their own internal processes. Any other...
I was just going to add that, you know, internally we've had some, you know, pressure from senior staff to say, hey, you know, you've got these requirements in the RA, you should be moving forward and don't dawdle, if you will. But we've also discovered that the development of this, to do it right and to do it, you know, in a form that people are going to both enjoy, if you will, but also learn from, you know, I think it's better that we take the time to develop the right thing, and rather than rush to meet a artificial deadline. But is there any reaction to the actual demo itself that you just saw? I mean, is that, do you feel we're going in the right direction with that? Is that the kind of thing you thought you were hoping to see, or you know, other feedback?
Yeah, I think it looked good. I mean, it looks very similar to, you know, some of the online training programs that maybe some of us in this room already use. So, yeah, no, I think it's a job well done. So I'd, you know, commend you guys for the work that you've done on it. And Tim, I wholeheartedly agree with what you said. I'd much rather do it right. And you know, there's a lot of material, so there's, to me, it doesn't make any sense to try to, you know, rush to some artificial deadline just to get something out there. I would much rather have it, you know, be done thoughtfully and slowly, as you guys are doing.
I'll just give my feedback that it was. I thought at first it was. Oh, this is too easy. You know, it's just stating the obvious. But then, you know, even the engaging and interesting, and you know, and especially the quiz question was very thought provoking. So yeah, stuff like that's great.
Thank you.
I thought it was really good. I thought it was excellent. Job well done.
Thank you.
Step in the right direction. It's a good work.
Thanks.
I want to mention that in addition to Mike working on this, Brian Peck is also helping him quite a bit, and I believe he's still online in the room listening in back in Marina Del Rey. Just a shout out to Brian and thank him for all the hard work that he and Mike have been putting into this.
And Brian, make sure you make Tim pay for the oodles of coffee I'm sure you're drinking to stay awake at this hour of the night.
Yeah, you know, I do have to say Brian has been really invaluable in you know, keeping us on the right path, you know, and you know, just the script, you know, we went through so many iterations, and you know, Brian was always more than happy to, you know, take the first effort always at making, you know, getting us to the next version. And so I would like to say my appreciation for that. And anyway, any other comments? Excellent. So I think I've got a slide with my email address on here. So if you happen to be feeling shy, which I've never known any registrar to feel shy, but you know, if you're feeling shy, or if something occurs to you later, by all means, please email me. You know, I'm happy to take whatever you've got. You know, I think that you know, I'm really happy to hear the positive feedback, and I think that it's really a result of the good input that we got from, you know, from registrars. You know, I was almost surprised that there was such good interest in trying to be a part of this, because I could have easily seen, you know, another sort of reaction, like, okay, one more thing we got to do, just show me where I check my box and I'll, you know, and I'll claim my certificate at the door. So I'm really glad that people are, you know, enthusiastically interested in this. And so, you know, by all means, please do send me your feedback, whether it's positive or critical. I think that's important. All right. Thank you all. Thank you all for your time and for, you know, being up at, well, it's no longer morning, but it started that way. So thank
and
you.
Brian sends his greetings and thanks you all for the great input that you continue to provide.